you and I are both a product of Western civilization, and the Green Plan is being practiced in Europe. What are the chances that it will be adopted in, say, Indonesia or China or somewhere that's in a very different region of the world?
If we were to use another term than Green Plan, it would be a business plan for government to manage, to use the wisdom that's evolved over time through this industrial process to realize, hey, management is a smart way to conserve energy. We don't wander around quite so much. We can get from point to point. And I would thus, I believe that every nation will undertake a Green Plan. China right now is, this week, a person in their government, the elected official in charge of environment, was listing the things China were doing, what it is doing, and they're almost more impressed than what we're doing, what they look at in the future. Their concern is this North-South dilemma that we pledged in Rio, we the industrialized nations of the North, to deliver 0.75% of our GNP so the South would not have to pollute, they could buy better equipment, and we would assist them. That's how the world could proceed. And the Chinese this week said, you know, that's what we've been waiting for. You've done nothing, world. Yet if we, the Chinese, all have automobiles the way you have automobiles, we'll all be dead.
0.75%. What's the number that we need to reach in order to be meeting this challenge appropriately?
The number, the U.S. and other countries have literally not started on that figure. We've been busy buying military equipment and paying huge agricultural subsidies and doing other things with our money.
Human beings can't be this stupid. What's holding us back?
The same problem, I think, of campaign reform in the U.S. You just have to sell your soul to get elected, to get the millions to do it. And those with the millions are the ones who have their main line into the federal treasury. There's lots of conflicts going on, but even that's changing. The grazing, mining, logging, stuff that environmentalists traditionally have battled, are starting to come closer to adjustment, primarily because we can't afford to give the stuff away anymore. But in the meantime, if you are a water person in industry, we'll say, in California, you get millions of acre feet of water, a tremendous amount of water, from the north, pumped to the south, 600 miles, costs you, the taxpayer, $300 a unit for all these millions of units, and yet you pay $10. So you get a gift of $290 every time one of those millions of units comes to you. You very wisely take a good portion of that and put it back into political contributions in the state capital at federal levels, to both parties, really. So you get the free water, which is the public's to begin with, but you control elections.
So the way things are drifting, it sounds like the only way through this dilemma is that we find a way to show that it's in our selfish interest to begin to live in harmony with our world.
Indeed. But I think we have an advantage. Young people know that. I'm not sure what the roots of that are. Much of it is television. As they were growing up as small children, the endless specials, the scientists talking about nature, National Geographic, special nonprofit educational programs. They have become well-educated and clearly informed. If we can survive for the next 20 years until they get out and start running institutions, I think the world will make it. It's our problem that those older citizens, my era, who've grown up expecting no limits to material opportunities, that are really the gravel in the gears, I think.
What changed your thinking?
My thinking, the realization that there were limits, I suppose, reading, appreciating that much of what we're dealing with has been repeated in history. Much of the conflicts of history have been the result of attempting to spread resources, the collapse of the Roman Empire. When you visit North Africa, you can stand by a Roman stone grape press that's 200 miles today from anything green, a piece of grass even. It was once a bread belt, the grain belt of Rome. Same thing that killed the Roman grain belt is killing California's grain belt, poor irrigation practices. And every developed nation in the world is doing the same thing. We're understanding, but in one sense it's suicidal. But in another, it is critical that we wake up, which we're doing, as I say. And one is hopeful that the juncture of awakening, so we get political support and change, will occur before we get beyond the ability to respond.
Who is your role model?
Well, I early on ran across a writer and professor who was dead before I discovered him, a fellow named Alu Leopold, who is like Rachel Carson. I would think he's even more quoted than Carson. I was at this conference earlier this week, and there were a great many nations there, and the speaker said, "How many of you read this fellow's chief book, A Sankai Almanac?" There were three Russians in the room. Their hands went up. And these were all deans of business schools from all over the world, 30 nations, that was it. And later, in a social function, I said, "You know of Leopold?" And they said, "Oh yes, he's a major source in our country. We have three different editions out now." And it's true in Germany as well. And he is an emerging American global leader after the fact. But he was probably the first practical ecologist who could put these problems in the context of what we do and so the public can understand and react in his writings. I wish I had known him, actually. I wish I could have studied under him. But I studied under someone who studied under him, so maybe that was his game.
Why don't we start where we would otherwise begin by introducing ourselves. I'm Douglas Gillies.
Huey Johnson.
And what do you do?
I am a working environmentalist. I'm president of the Resource Renewal Institute. It's an organization that is I've started after an evolution of being in a number of environmental organizations successfully, or in industry, or in research, or teaching and other things too. But in the end, I concluded we now know enough to solve the problem. That the issue was to define how we would do that. If we can build computers and airplanes, we can solve the environmental problem.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure to see you, Huey.
Thank you. Great pleasure to be here.
Hazel Henderson was talking to me about companies absorbing the costs of environmental, the environmental impact of their work in fair pricing. Is that being picked up and used? What would force businesses to do that?
The reality of the costs of the past, they find out that it's cheaper not to pollute, to not bother to clean the pollution up in the water or in the air, but instead use technologies that don't create the pollution. That has become a far less expensive way to proceed, and that's become kind of the fashion internationally now.
What I find in the business communities that I'm connected with is a dawning realization of the problem, but a tremendous amount of inertia that is rooted in the business model about what is successful in business. And I'm wondering, you talked about trauma changing it. Mm-hmm. We thought after Three Mile Island, well, that would change it.
Yes.
It didn't. Then we thought, well, if something big happened, well, Chernobyl is about as big as you'd want to happen in terms of the winds and affecting Sweden and so
right.
on. I mean, how much do you want? What trauma? Because trauma has an immediate short-term effect, but the long-term reorientation of philosophy that's necessary for the underpinning of a real change of value, I'm wondering, what does it take, and what do you see the scenario that could do it?
The great lesson in recent years for me, getting older and losing my hair, and
yeah.
so, is that I finally started understanding that there was a word, time. I've always before wanted things to happen. Now, we've got a plan. I want to see the results. I've realized that many times complex changes in society are like a huge ship changing course. They don't make 90-degree turns. And I view many of these themes almost as trends. And thus, any boost you get can affect, maintain, and speed up that
That's
pace.
Great.
A company like Patagonia, California clothing company, gives percentage before profits to the environmental movement. It creates clothing that is built to last many years longer than just fashionable stuff. And governments do the same thing. Corporations of another scale do the same thing. But that has become an interesting symbol when you're around Patagonia much. There are corporations who come to visit it, the great big ones, saying, gosh, how do you do it? How do you limit your growth to 7% a year, which they do, and still increase your profits, which they do? And so we have these examples, and I think, as much as anything, human beings really change when they see examples working. So you need, I like the example of Holland as a nation. True, it is small. New Zealand or Singapore. But they have made a national purpose that of cleaning up the environment, and they're doing it. So we look around and say, gee, if they can do it, we can do it. A good example was looking at the right to vote for women. Everybody talked about it, but the first nation to let it happen was New Zealand. And the rest of the world looked and saw that New Zealand didn't fall apart because it let women vote, and then the U.S. and Germany and others said, yeah, we can let women vote. But until we see it happening, we're not inclined to then take that next big step.
Robert Mueller had the same time perspective that you were just talking about. He said, 20 years ago, no country had an environmental ministry. Now, 20 years later, he said at the Rio conference, he said, there they were, all of them.
Right.
And he said, look at that, just in 20 years.
Yeah.
And he says, now from the next 20 years, we went from the human over the environment. Now we move to the human and the environment. Now the next 20 years is the environment first and the human second.
That's a wonderful thought.
Isn't it a beauty?
I like it too.
I believe it too. So with age comes a shift in perspective.
Right. Maybe.
Tell me about aging and shift in your agenda, or how you see your agenda shifts with age.
I am less upset by events. I see them in the context of a flow of time and process. And thus I don't celebrate particularly when I win at an issue, nor do I get depressed when I lose one. I have a greater sense of shared purpose. I still understand we have to have individual leaders, and on occasion have that opportunity and do carry out that role. As part of understanding time, I also appreciate that it's unlikely that any one event is that important. So I don't really celebrate particularly if I win something or get depressed if I lose something in the way of issues that relate to environmental quality. And I also am optimistic, far more so than I was when I was young. I realize that there is a growing shared concern. Humanity has a tremendous latent potential to join together to solve problems. And I believe we will do that.
You said earlier about the fact that this is a youth issue. I mean, I'm aware that when I'm working with teenagers, that the environment is their issue.
Right.
And it's much more than our issue. We have to import it into our consciousness because we grew up with a different worldview. So now, as an older person, would you realign your energies to work with youth more, do you think, than working with existing political leaders? I mean, can you hear that issue?
I can, but if I prioritize the issues, I've had enough experience at the various levels. I understand that if I get to someone who has what's called policy authority, a Gorbachev when he's president, the head of a huge corporation, Hewlett Packard, who can buy my idea and then send it out as a directive for everybody to follow, that in the sense of stemming things or having the greatest impact for the years I had and the energy I have, I put most of my energy into attempting to influence institutions. At the same time, I do, whenever I can, I do a good deal, work with young people, lecture or attempt to make my case in magazines or publications.
There's been a lot of talk at this conference about sustainable consumerism and about greed, basically. And the human condition, at times I feel that without so oppressive legislation, like the multinationals are like pirates on the high seas, it all just runs on and on and on because the money group that puts the money into the elections. I mean, you passed over that earlier,
yes,
saying that's part of the inertia of the system. What's the, Who are they, and because they are they, not us, apparently. And what's their game? What is it that they're, is the environment is a threat to them?
Well,
Or environmental consciousness is a threat to them.
There's a danger in oversimplifying here. I don't see the corporate juggernaut as a juggernaut. When I went into it, I had a tour of public service as an official in state government where I was responsible for the environment. And I went in, including water and parks and wildlife and forests. And I went in thinking there was this massive folks in the back room dealing out the water of the state, for instance. And I found that it was a confused human condition, and there were several thousand of them. And that isn't clear from outside. And it's equally true when you look at the corporate theme. There is a very progressive, growing sector of industry that we would deem environmentally ethical at the highest standards. I used as an example some of the communications people. I suggested Hewlett-Packard, Intel, others. And the chemicals, I suggested, could list a bunch of those. They've suddenly become very environmental. I use 3M, DuPont is coming, and others. There's still a huge sector of bad guys. I would come up with some of the forest products companies. Louisiana Pacific are just bandits. They've got record, they've just cheated. They've got more tickets for violations over the years. And there's that sector. But the important thing to remember is that we've got to let them, and they do change. They'll change. When all of a sudden it makes sense, these companies are making more profit by managing their affairs carefully, by being environmentally ethical, by being concerned, understanding that's part of marketing. The companies not doing it are increasingly, those top executives, often their employees are way ahead of the company, saying, yeah, we ought to be like those people. And the human condition applies in corporations as well. I think that it is an error. It reinforces the bad guys who want to keep everybody in the club and not let them increase that other group increase. And I use the Dutch example where 80,000 Dutch businesses of 100 employees or more are right out in front leading environmental change.
No, that's
totally
a brilliant example. That's a brilliant example. Yeah. It's a very foreign example.
It's really important to visit Holland today and have a staff person in Holland to meet you at the airplane because seeing is believing. Mm-hmm. Or New Zealand.
In projecting forward 20 years, 40 years, do you think that the society is ready to handle the increasing darkness before the light? Because you can see on the inertial path of the system at
right.
this moment that the change will come after some time. I mean, we have time perspective, it's true. But the destabilization that occurs in the process, the Chicago image of the bellowing smoke and the fear of going out at night, that destabilizes the whole system so much. How do you foresee, what do you see down the road in terms of these pictures?
I think if we move to process and understand that part of process are these negatives, always there, always present. There are always disease vectors around us in our bodies, every day of our lives, for instance. But a healthy body restrains those germs that we breathe in during a particular phase when we walk in the park or something. And that societies function the same way. And I believe that the problems are real and that there are, by creating a politics of hope, by rewarding those corporations that are demonstrating a better way, by buying their stuff, by giving them awards, by having society share in the process of carrying us through these downsides. I think it's essential we have political leadership, which is missing at the moment. It takes courageous political leadership to stand up at Gorbachev's scale and confront tanks if necessary and say, we're going to go in this direction. And it's interesting to hear him as we had dinner tonight. He said, you know, I got to that point where everybody was telling me, oh, the Americans hate us, we've got to build more bombs. He said, hey, wait a minute. He is sure the Americans don't hate us that much at all. We're going over the side, guys. Stop.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, that's leadership.
That's leadership, yes. We got to stop.
That's right.
Okay. We have to stop, too. Thank you.